This week, on Behind the Lens, coronavirus and school children. We'll take a look at how a system of independent charter schools develops strategies for dealing with a potential outbreak. Community advocates link up in New Orleans to fight pollution in Cancer Alley and beyond.
I cannot go outside in my neighborhood and look at a family that has not or is not now suffering.
Also, Nick Krastel talks about his groundbreaking investigation of mass incarceration, the Section G Project. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by Community Support. Show your support today at thelensnola.org/donate. The United Nations Education Agency, UNESCO, reports that more than 290 million children in 13 countries are cutting class. They have no choice. Their schools, mainly in China, have had to close due to the COVID-19 virus epidemic. New Orleans school children are not among them, but school officials here are talking about what precautions they need to take now. Marta Jusen has more.
Basically, that district officials are wanting to work with charter school leaders to make sure that they are prepared for this. They've all met on Tuesday, some in person, some via telephone. They're addressing a variety of issues that could come out of this potential spread of the virus.
What are some of the measures that are being discussed among school officials?
So we really have a variety of issues at stake here. You know, obviously education is at the forefront. That's what we're thinking of. And the potential for online classes is being discussed. That's something that the district would probably help coordinate, but at this point, that would be a decision that charter schools would make themselves. Also, citywide, if tourism goes down, that could affect tax dollars, and tax dollars are what fund our public schools. So there is a little bit of concern that this could hit the budget and the per pupil funding that schools see. I talked to one school leader who said that district officials were talking about alternative revenue models that they have used in previous years when they've seen a dip in tourism money. So we don't know exactly what that would look like yet, but they are paying attention to it. And then this also extends to our enrollment system. So they now have worked into one app. I believe it's a question about whether or not you've traveled to a potentially affected country or state. And right. If you have traveled to that area or state, you would not be able to enroll in school for 14 days. Or they would enroll you, but you wouldn't be allowed to attend for 14 days.
We have dozens of charter schools in the city.
Correct.
They have their own policies. They run their own calendars. Are they all responsible for their own strategies in case they have to deal with an outbreak among students?
Essentially, they are. I mean, charters, like you said, are responsible for their own day-to-day operations. That is the whole basis of charters, is that they are independent and free to make those decisions. And what happens in a situation like this is that they are responsible for their day-to-day operations and everything they do until a point where the district wanted to step in and pull rank. Then the district could essentially do that because these schools are contractors for the district.
Has that authority ever been exercised?
It's unclear to me if they've exactly used that state law before, but there have been cases where the district has mandated that schools close. They did that, for instance, during Tropical Storm Gordon in 2018.
The state standardized testing is coming up into this month?
Yep, that's when some of it starts, correct?
What happens, is there any indication from school officials of what contingencies they would have to develop with regard to those standardized tests? I mean, those are critically important.
The district has not outlined a specific plan yet about what they would do for state testing, but they said that the Louisiana Department of Education does have a contingency plan. We've asked the state for more details about that, and we're hoping to hear back soon.
And there are a handful of teachers in the metro area that have not been at school as of late. Tell me the latest on this beat.
That has occurred, to our knowledge, in two different situations. One is at a high school in Jefferson Parish, where two or maybe three teachers had traveled internationally over the break to areas that the Center for Disease Control has identified as a place where you could potentially be exposed, or at, you know, an area that has had a higher presence of the coronavirus. So those teachers went into work on Monday, and then starting Tuesday, the administration asked them to stay home. Mm-hmm. A similar situation is occurring at a local Catholic school, I believe, that two teachers have chosen to what they're calling self-isolate and stay home for the next 2 weeks. That, I think, does bring up an interesting point in how we've been planning for this is that, you know, everyone was on break for a week over Mardi Gras. Right. Maybe this is something that we should have been thinking about last Friday and communicating with people based on where they had traveled instead of everyone returning to school on Monday, students, staff, and families alike, and then telling people to go home on Tuesday.
And just be clear, there have been no positive reports of COVID-19 infections here in Louisiana.
Correct. We have, just from the Times-Picayune right now that I read, is they have tested one person in the state and that came back negative.
Mara Jusen, thank you very much for your reporting.
Thank you.
Thursday evening, a progressive community group called the New Orleans Coalition invited members to hear from some of the top figures in the movement opposing industrial pollution in the river parishes. Much of the meeting centered on plans by Formosa Plastics, a Taiwanese company, to build a huge plastics production center in the heart of St. James Parish. But it was also an opportunity for attendees to learn about what motivated these residents to become active in the first place. Robert Taylor with the Concerned Citizens of St. John talked about the former DuPont chloroprene plant in his parish. It's now operated by the Japanese firm Dinka. But Taylor says pollution from that plant continues to take a toll on the community, including his immediate family.
They went into business. DuPont did in 1968. That's the year that I completed construction on my new home and that our youngest daughter was born. And we moved into this house, which is in that particular zone. That's the highest rate in the United States. She was born into that. She was breathing chloroprene from the day we brought her home from the hospital. She grew up and became the caretaker of the family. She's a nurse. But now she's totally incapacitated as the result of a disease, immune system disease that she has. That is, it occurs one in a million. We have four young ladies in our community, in our census tract, that have that very rare disease. And they say it's caused by chloroprene. But beyond that, my wife is a cancer survivor. My mother didn't survive, nor did my brother, nor did my nieces and nephews. I could go on and on in my family. Besides, I cannot go outside of in my neighborhood and look at a family that has not or is not now suffering from these rare cancers. My next door neighbor, the guy who moved back from New Orleans in order to build in this new subdivision that gave us poor folk an opportunity to own a home, and he moved his family back from New Orleans. He died from a special type of esophageal cancer. He has one son. He has two sons that are now suffering from the same cancer. He lives right across the street from me. The other guy I grew up with on this side, he and his wife both died. We had his brother died right up the street. I mean, I could just go on about people were just, they did not understand what it was. I don't know if they fully, well, I think they understand, but they feel helpless.
That's Robert Taylor with the Concerned Citizens of St. John. Sharon Levine was also there. She founded Rye St. James to oppose petrochemical development in her own parish. Levine told the audience about her efforts to convince the governor to block Formosa's construction plans.
We've been writing letters to the governor. He haven't answered my letter yet. I met with the governor on November 1st when he came to St. James to solicit our votes. He was told to ask for me. So our Beverly and my brother and myself wore our yellow shirts. We asked the other members to wear their yellow shirts so they can see us on the front line, but they refused. So me and Beverly and my brother wore our yellow shirts. So Chuck Carl Brown knew who to come to. He didn't have to look too hard. So he came to me and asked me if I was Sharon Levine. I said, yes, I am. And he asked me, would I speak with the governor? I said, sure, I'd love to speak to the governor. So I could tell him a thing or two. So when it was time for him to come to my table, after I ate the last spoon of my grits, because it was a breakfast thing they had going on, he was watching me. And he came to the table and said, are you ready? I said, well, I just ate the last piece of meat and grits. So I told him, okay. So my brother and I went up there, and Miss Mary from St. John, she came up there too. And he shook my hand, and he told Miss Mary that we brought the emissions down to 85% in St. John with Dinker. And Chuck Carl Brown told him, this is Sharon Levine. Tell the governor about Formosa. I turned to the governor, I told him, I want to ask you not to let Formosa come into St. James. And he said, I'm going to do a health study. I told him, I'm going to do a health study too. Then he said a few more things after that, but my brother said, I said a whole lot, but I don't remember what I said. I did say a lot. And then Chuck Carl Brown gave me his card and told me we're going to call them. They will set me up with an appointment with the governor. Called the office three times, left my name and number, no response.
Chuck Carl Brown, by the way, leads the state's Department of Environmental Quality. Sharon Levine of Rye St. James says she still is waiting for responses from Brown and the governor's office itself. Levine and Taylor have a lot of support from advocates right here in the city of New Orleans. Sylvia Lambton is a co-moderator of Justice and Beyond. She says New Orleans residents have plenty of reasons to join with their neighbors in Cancer Alley.
So when we heard about everything that was going on, I said, well, God, I'm stepping out of myself. And I'm going to step into Miss Sharon and Mr. Robert, which I watched them several times. And my mom used to cry. I used to cry. And I went in these areas, but I never went into the depth of the chemical plants. Seeing it from the Bonnie Carey spillway on the I-10 isn't nothing. You got to be close up to see the poison that sits in between the stack and the white smoke that we see belligerent all over. I also live in Chalmette. It's cancer out there. So when they say germ forces together, there's no such thing as black and white. We all need to be in this fight together. Absolutely. And take it seriously. We cannot live without one another. No one, it won't be fit for no civilization. And we have to remember, we got to give God his praise. For Katrina, he slapped us and said, wake up, you so-called Christians. I'm here. Pay attention, he collecting souls. It's a battle, and you can feel a spiritual battle. Just feel it. It's so real. But I always say, God, forgive us, for we do not know what we are doing. But if you lead us, teach us, and guide us, we can't go wrong.
All right.
So I thank God for being a part of this panel. It's much more hurt and pain that goes with it, but we ask that y'all join us, and yes, we will join y'all as well.
That's Sylvia Lambton with Justice and Beyond and the Coalition Against Death Alley. We want to thank the New Orleans Coalition for inviting the Lens to cover this meeting. And we want to invite the governor, LDEQ, and company officials from Formosa Plastics and Dinka to respond to the comments we've included in this podcast. Speedy is his name. Justice is swiftest in Shea's court. Verbose lawyers beware. These are all old newspaper headlines trumpeting the work of Judge Frank Shea at New Orleans Criminal District Court. Shea spent 33 years on the bench there, and in many ways, he became the poster child for a system of mass incarceration that still exists in Louisiana. Nicholas Krastel has examined Shea's work and his behavior in depth for a four-part series called the Section G Project. We're also showcasing Nick's work in a new series of podcasts. He spoke with us about his investigation.
I became aware of Judge Frank Shea over 3 years ago. I got to know an investigator who had formerly worked for the Innocence Project, and he told me about the story of Aaron Hunter, who had been convicted in Judge Shea's courtroom, and this investigator had subsequently worked on his case with the Innocence Project. So my introduction to Shea was through this trial, which lasted a single morning, and during which Hunter was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. It was intriguing to me and somewhat troubling to me that someone could be convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole in a single morning. And when I began to look into Judge Shea's career, it turns out that this was something that Shea prided himself on, moving trials as quickly as he possibly could.
He campaigned on it, in fact.
In fact, yes, he campaigned on it. As I continued to look into his career, you know, speed was the his prevailing concern, but his behavior on the bench in order to keep things moving was often quite outrageous. And lawyers who practiced in his courtroom, you know, have stories of him berating them and yelling at them to keep things moving. Some of them found that troubling. Some of them look back with some sense of humor about it. But all these things were compelling to me, and as I continued to look into his career.
Yeah. And he's a pretty compelling character, colorful, if you will.
Yeah, that's one word for it, certainly.
You, having looked across the span of this decades-long career for Frank Shea at Section G, and during that time, according to your reporting, Louisiana's rate of incarceration jumped from 13th to 2nd in the nation. Where are we now?
Well, after Shea retired, Louisiana became number one in the nation. And then last year, a couple years ago, we once again were second, I believe, and now are back to number one again. Currently, Louisiana is the most incarcerated state in the nation. And that trajectory to get there really, really began during Shea's time on the bench.
And of course, a lot of the interviews that you conducted point to the fact that while Shea was in many ways iconic in terms speed of trial and mass incarceration, he was not the only one in that building. Basically ran a trial like that.
Yeah,
he wasn't.
That's right. Most of the sources I talked to thought that Shea was outrageous in a lot of ways, and I think more concerned with speed than a number of the other than probably any other judge. But in many ways was very much very similar to the other judges in terms of how he handled his courtroom. Which is to say that the sentences he was handing out, the general expectations of people practicing in front of him, and sort of a general attitude towards defendants at the time, which I think would strike many people today as troubling.
Well, you still have quite a bit of reporting to do in this series. We continue in both your written stories and podcasting with the Section G podcast. Ultimately, what do you want people to take away from your reporting here? What's the message? What do we need to learn from this?
You know, right now, Louisiana is quite conscious of its position as the most incarcerated place on earth. And a lot of people are working to change that, and a lot of people are working to reform the system to reduce our incarceration rate for various reasons. But what I wanted to do was really illustrate in a sort of granular way how we got here, and so that's why I decided to look at Judge Shea's courtroom specifically as one sort of small piece of this broader picture of how we came to be the most incarcerated state.
I mean, we're still living in Frank Shea's world when it comes to criminal justice in a lot of ways.
That's exactly right. Also, and a lot of the people who were practicing at that time are still around. You know, including Judge Ziblage and a number of other judges were practicing in front of him. So, to understand that this legacy is still very much a part of how people are thinking about criminal justice, and the fact that, you know, many people who are sentenced in front of Shea are still in prison today. And how should we be thinking about cases that were tried, you know, in a matter of hours, when people were getting these long prison sentences, and how do we address those issues today?
Well, it's great reporting. There's a lot to it, and looking forward to more on this beat with you. Nick Krastel, reporting for The Lens. Thank you so much, Nick.
Thanks, Tom.
You can find his articles and the Section G podcast at our website, thelensnola.org. Nick's work and the rest of our efforts are made possible by the support of listeners and readers just like you. Learn more and give today at thelensnola.org/donate. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting Behind the Lens.